The Athlete CEO Podcast. Let's go. Okay, so I'm joined by the lovely Hannah McQueen, founding director of Enable Me New Zealand. And it's firstly, just want to say a huge thank you for taking the time to jump on and have a chat. Really excited to hear a bit about your story, but also some of the amazing work that you do. So I guess before we start, a brief intro, 30-second bio for our listeners.
Am I giving the intro? Or
yeah,
are you giving
yeah,
the intro?
No,
okay,
no, sorry, yeah.
Okay, well, okay. So I run a company called Enable Me, and we call ourselves financial personal trainers. And our job is to work with our clients to maximize their financial progress while they work with us. Mm-hmm. Most people that we work with are earning fairly good income. Some are earning exceptional income. But what we know is that earning income doesn't actually translate to progress. If anything, it kind of gives you permission to not do what you should do because you don't have to worry about money anymore. And our job is to work with clients to improve their behavior, to change their mindset, to get a strategy happening, and to ultimately get better results. And there is some science behind how we do that. But one of the most effective tools is good old-fashioned accountability, right?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Accountability plays a huge role. And so could you share a little bit around, I guess, how you started or even take us a bit further back? Where was Hannah? Where did she grow up? And, you know, what was life like growing up for Hannah?
Okay. Well, Hannah grew up in Hawke's Bay. And she left school at 16 and moved to Auckland. And I studied commerce and law, specifically taxation law. And I graduated as with my master's in tax law and commerce, a commerce degree. I became a chartered accountant. And I guess you could say that I'm financially literate and I'm financially confident by that background. But my story and how it kind of led to what I do now is I needed to get my first mortgage, which was $350,000. And I did what everyone does. You know, you play the banks off against each other and you get a really good deal. But I was still going to be paying close to $1 million back to the bank. So that was three times what I borrowed. And I thought, that's kind of crazy. How can I pay less? And I guess the weird thing was is that I thought I had negotiated really well because I'd got this really nice interest saving. Mm. But it was that interest saving was going to save me $12,000 out of the $1 million I was going to pay back to the bank over the 30 years. And so I'm thinking, well, look, you can keep the 12 grand, just save me the million, you know? And so I went to my banker and I said, hey, I want to pay my mortgage off faster. How can I do that? And she's like, well, you can shorten your term. So instead of it being a 30-year period, make it a shorter period. And I'm like, yeah, well, I understand that. But if I do that, I'm committing to higher repayments kind of for a fixed period of time. And if I can't actually achieve that, then I'm going to have a break cost. So I'm going to be penalized by that. And if I'm being honest with you, there were some months where I couldn't even manage the minimum repayment comfortably. So the idea of kind of artificially trying to increase it seemed a bit, just a bit crazy. And so I said, well, there's got to be another way. And she's like, well, you could, if you want to pay your mortgage off at your leisure, so instead of it being a fixed, regimented amount each month, go on to a floating interest rate, and then you can pay it off without being penalized. And I'm like, yeah, but a floating interest rate's 1.5% higher than a fixed rate. So there's got to be a point at which the benefit of being able to pay your mortgage off is offset with the higher cost. And so then she's like, correct. And I'm like, well, can you tell me what that point is? And she's like, no. So well, this is kind of an annoying conversation. Or then she would say, well, why don't you, because I don't know about you, but I find whenever you go to show initiative, you tend to regret it quite quickly afterwards. So if I was going to, if I happened upon some money that I could put towards my mortgage, sure as eggs, I'd need that money back the next day. So how can I get some flexibility? And she's like, well, you could have a revolving credit facility where you're supposed to pay off your mortgage at your leisure, and whatever you pay off, you can re-access. And so I'm thinking, okay, that's cool, but we use a credit card to facilitate that, right? So you're supposed to put your living costs on a credit card, and you get 50 days free credit, and then you pay your credit card off the next month. Anyway, that's how the story goes, and the personal banker could show me a really nice graph. Apart from the fact that when you use a credit card, studies have shown that you are more likely to spend more with a credit card. And so I was trying to work out, well, what interest would I save doing it the bank's way? And I think using this credit card for the 50 days free credit was going to save me, I don't know, $50 a month in interest. So it was a legitimate saving, but I would more likely to spend more than $50 a month just because I'm using a credit card. So the whole thing was just a waste of time. And it was as frustrating for her as it was for me. And so I thought, well, I actually do want to pay my mortgage off faster, and I want to do that to have maximum flexibility, and I want to save as much money as possible. So there has to be this optimal way to structure debt. And so I don't even know why I did this, to be honest, but I tootled off to the University of Auckland, and contacted their mathematics department and asked if they would help me work on a formula to structure my debt so I could pay it off as quickly as possible. And 6 months later, and 8 pages of calculus later, I had a formula that would save me the size of my mortgage, which was 350 grand in interest.
Wow.
And so I'm like, well, that's awesome. And I patented that formula, but for the formula to work, and this is probably the crux, you need to have money left over that you could put towards paying your debt off faster. And I'm like, well, yeah, that makes sense. Apart from the fact I have no money left over.
Yeah.
I was earning the most money I ever earned, and I was financially literate, because everyone says you just need to improve your literacy and you'll be better with money. And I'm like, knowing what to do doesn't make you do it if you're a shopper, which I am. I prefer to spend money than to save. And so how do you make someone like me, someone who likes nice things and works hard, so feels she deserves nice things, how do I become financially successful? Because it's not helpful for you to tell me just spend less money. It's like, well, why? Give me a reason to. And if you can't, then I will. And that's the classic shopper, I guess, conundrum. But what I did is I thought, well, I'm going to address this. And that's what I started to do 11 years ago when I formed Enable Me Financial Personal Trainers. And our job is to help people like me get leaner financially so that we can achieve our financial capability. And in doing that, often we need have a mortgage that we need to get rid of, and we usually need to use equity to grow wealth. Mm-hmm. And the reality is, for our generation, that financial success is no longer a default outcome for working hard. If anything, the default is that you won't quite get there. And so my job is to change that for the clients that I work with.
And there's a nice snippet right there. But it's so true, isn't it? Like, because, you know, for our listeners, I went and attended one of Hannah's presentation seminars down here in Rotorua, and I've been to many. And I guess the biggest takeaway that I got was relatability, right? How you were able to articulate it, but in such a, I guess, for everyday people like myself, right, to understand. Because I think I know when I was an athlete, I had tried to try and get stuff sorted, but I just couldn't understand what they were saying. And then I had left, right, and center, life insurance, and all this other stuff coming at me. And I'm like, what is all this? And so I ended up just saying no to it. I was like, no, I don't really understand, because how much of it, and this is something that you said in your presentation, is money is more a psychology and a mindset than it is about literacy. Yeah. Can you expand on that?
Well, yes. So I think that financial success comes down to behavior with a strategy. And I think 80% of financial success is to do with your psychology of spending or your tendencies around money. And you don't need to be financially literate to be successful with money. If anything, I think that gives you a bias to think you know what you're doing. And in most instances, you don't. Or there's room to improve, but you are too defensive to see it. So when we're trying to understand or working with clients to work out their psychology of spending, you have these tendencies which indicate what you do most naturally. Because there's no point kind of willing yourself to be different. You are what you are. Let's understand what that means. And if there's a gap, let's make sure we're closing that gap so that your flank isn't exposed. So if we start with your money personality, you are either a shopper, a saver, or a plotter. So a shopper simply finds it easier to spend money rather than save. They're not necessarily nicer people. They're not necessarily spending money on themselves. But if you can't give them a reason to save, then they just find it easier to spend. So that's me. And a saver tends to be the exact opposite. They find it easier to save rather than spend. And for them, they need a reason to spend, which can be a bit weird. Or as a shopper, I think that's weird. And a plotter is someone who isn't really either. They can save when they need to, but they can spend just as freely. So your tendency is really interesting, because when we're trying to work out your strategy around money, depending on if you're a shopper or a saver, we've got different strategic tendencies that accompany that. So shoppers need big goals. They need a reason not to spend. They're not interested in the minute details of where the money goes. They will engage if it's exciting, and if it's not, then they tune out. Whereas a saver is the opposite. The bigger the goal, the more freaked out they become. And so what's interesting is that the shoppers tend to be a bit useless with money management, but they have a strategic advantage, whereas the savers are better with money management, but they've got a strategic disadvantage. And together, unless we can design the plan for them, their tendency is to do nothing and to make very little progress. And I think that's one of the frustrating things, because in my, well, two generations ago, so in my grandparents' day, you didn't even need to earn good money. You just needed to be not bad with your money. You didn't even need to be good, just not bad. And if you could delay your gratification, that was enough to ensure you would be okay in the end. Whereas for our generation, you have to be great with money and make purposeful progress, otherwise you're not going to get there. And most people aren't going to get there. It's the reality.
And I guess for me, in the industry that I work in with professional athletes, and it's something that I am seeing time and time and time again, is our professional sports stars finishing their careers with virtually nothing. Some don't even own a home. Some only own one after a 10, 12, 13 year career, earning on average between $300,000 and $500,000 a year over those 10 years. For me, I always try and figure out why is that still happening, and what is being done about it.
Not enough.
Because it's always, for me, I understand that a lot of these young players are thrust into the limelight at such a young age, 18, 19 years of age, even 20, earning $200,000-$400,000. If the psychology, if you say money is a psychology, what can I guess professional athletes start to do in order to make sure that they have a nest egg, or they can at least start the journey?
I think the first thing that needs to be acknowledged is you've got this time in the sun, right? Where you have this God-given blessing of earning some amazing income, but it's only for a period of time. And your job, your responsibility, is to not let that fall to the ground and to maximize what you achieve in that period. But so that when the period is over and the sun is no longer shining, that you have positioned yourself for the next stage by growing your wealth while you can. So the, and that's like, that makes sense. Apart from the fact that when the money comes in to start with, it just feels good, right? And you don't really want to adult up. You kind of, you just want to kind of ride the wave, baby. And you can, but at some point the wave stops. And you don't want to look back on your opportunity and think, I wish I had. My preference is to work with clients at the start of that opportunity and say, let's maximize this. Because I think the other thing with, I mean, athletes aren't the only profession that earns good income for a short period of time. Like I work with people who might earn more than $1 million, but what we know is that the higher the income that you earn, normally the shorter the period you will be able to earn that income. So because you burn out, there is a cost. That's why you're paid the premium. I think one of the distinguishing factors about athletes, though, is that they pursue their athletic career at the expense of developing other fallback options, right? Because you're all, this is why you're here, right? And you're going to make sure that's not the case.
Yeah.
But because of that, there is more of an onus to do something with your, with this while you've got the chance. And too easily, if you don't have someone in your corner who knows what's the best thing for you to do, then you either do nothing or you do something stupid. And we want, so I think, Siona, your example was that all these people are trying to sell you products, and it's like, I don't even, just can you stop? So you, it's not even whether they're the right products. People just see you. There's a target on your back because you're easy prey. You're earning all this money and you need someone to help you. So people just throw things at athletes or high earners. But we have to take a measured approach and a strategic approach. And what might be right for you might not be right for someone else based on who they are and what they're trying to achieve in their window of opportunity.
Yeah. And that's, I love what you say about that, because, you know, I was overly critical of some sports organizations around how they were trying to deliver this stuff, right? Because for me, I know that a blanket approach doesn't often, you know, achieve the outcomes. But I know from personal experience and speaking to other athletes, this whole shame factor, it really is real around asking for help, because there's this like face mask that some athletes wear to perceive that everything's fine and they've got everything in order, when really they don't. How what's one of the ways that we could, I guess me especially, that I could start spreading some messages or getting our athletes to seek help in this sort of area?
Well, I think we need to reframe it for them. It's not about whether your house is in order. It's about maximizing your opportunity.
Yeah.
And in doing that, you will naturally get lean and you will naturally get your house in order, and you'll do that because what we can achieve will be so attractive to you that you level up. And if we can't make it attractive, then you wouldn't bother, because I wouldn't. And as a shopper, you'd be like, well, what's the point? I'd rather spend the money. But if we can show you, say, how we could save 50% more than what you're saving. If you had a mortgage, how we could get you mortgage free in 5 years. If we could get a plan together, if we could grow $2 million or $5 million worth of wealth, if we could just drive an outcome and you are in control of your destiny, not just hoping that it'll somehow work out, because that's not what a plan is.
But
these guys and girls, on one hand, they do get it though, right? Because I work with clients to help achieve high performance in their money and with their money and wealth. And so I don't really care if they're naturally a bit useless. I will get them to high performance. and then I think they get that from a coaching perspective, right? Because you have a coach to get the best out of you. And some there'll be some areas where you're a bit useless with everything, right?
Mm.
And there'll be other areas where you have a natural opportunity. You just need your coach to blend it together so that you get what you need by the time you need to get it.
Mm. That's so true. It's almost like, I love what you said, you know, about the sun shining and then eventually, you know, it stops shining, and the wave stops. What we're trying to achieve with our athletes is to make sure that the wave continues and the sun never stops. And I've always seen that the position that they're in right now, with the amount of money that they're earning and putting a plan in place, is to make sure that they can at least maximize those opportunities, and the sun isn't as dim as what it would be if had they not done it.
Yeah, I guess the key is that they need to leverage off their chance, right? Mm. And it is so much easier to leverage when you have money to help you.
Yeah.
That's just unfortunately, the way of life. It is easier when you've got money. Especially so you've earned all this money while you've been an athlete, and then you're moving to the next stage. The more wealth we can create, the greater the chance that next stage is going to give you what you want.
Mm.
Otherwise, you run the risk of lowering the bar or settling for whatever you can get.
Yeah.
And money's a weird one, right? Because it's intrinsically linked to your self-worth,
yeah,
and your self-esteem, and it's all through relationships. But no one talks about it honestly.
Mm.
And people tend to overstate how they're doing,
mm-hmm,
or just ignore it completely. And yeah, give them an hour with me and let's see what we can do.
Yeah. Okay. So I wanted to run a quick scenario past you, and it's this. So I've just signed an extension of a contract. I'm on $300,000 a year.
Yeah.
I have $20,000 in personal debt, and I currently own my own home with a mortgage of $400,000.
Yeah.
Help me.
How real is this example?
No.
So what I'm just thinking of a client that's on a similar level of income, similar situation. Okay, yes. Firstly, you shouldn't have personal debt, right? That is just so... We will fix that.
Okay.
So the goal would be, in the first year, would be to find or to save about $150,000. So within the first month, we'd pay off that debt. We'd support you to save, because no one saves unless someone's helping them and has a different bank account structure and accountability. And I'll explain how we do all of that. But we'll save $150,000. We'll get you in control of the money. We'll clear that short-term debt. And we'll probably look to get you mortgage free in between 4 to 6 years. So that would be the default. But in this year, if you had the appetite, and I hope that you would, we would look to buy one or two properties, investment properties outside of your home. And so we'd work out what those properties need to look like, the criteria, because I don't believe in just doing something. I want to know that I'm doing the right thing for me, my situation and my goals. And so that criteria goes through, well, what does that investment property need to look like? Where is it going to be? What is it going to cost? What is the rent? And all of those things. It'll be really sharp.
Mm.
And then we go and find those properties for you. So you don't have to do anything apart from be on board.
Yeah.
And we'll do as much as we can.
And so,
I know I left it to your devices, it wouldn't happen.
Yeah,
I don't mean that in a disrespectful way. It's the same as if you left it to
Before
I was at Enable Me. I didn't do anything.
And so, you know, you said that you'd save $150,000. How does that look?
Well, we'd work out, well, what do you need to be happy? So within a budget, you've got the cost that you have to incur. You know, you've got to pay for your accommodation, and you've got to feed the family and clothe the family. And there'll be kind of a base level of expenses that you want to be able to spend, which is just part of your everyday kind of minimum costs. And that stretches depending on the situation. So some of the fixed costs that these athletes might have might be that, I mean, on the assumption that they probably have this for free, but an example is they might need gym memberships or some of these things. That's part of their fixed costs. When I say fixed costs, I don't just mean living a really frugal Scottish lifestyle. And then I'll work out what are the things in addition to that that you need to be happy. So for me, I need to have a cleaner. I need to go on holiday a couple of times a year. I want my kids to have activities. These aren't, well, these, for me, they're my non-negotiable. Because if you take them away, I'm thinking, well, why am I working so hard if I can't do some of those things? And I'll have my things, and my partner's got his things, which don't make me happy at all, but they make him happy. Like his non-negotiables is his PlayStation games and his Xbox games and his motorbike and art. And I'm like, well, that doesn't do much for me. But there is no point living to a plan unless you're both happy.
Yeah.
It's just in the absence of a plan, you tend to spend more than what you realize on things, and you're no happier as a result. And we know that you're not happier, because when we stop spending money on those things, you're no less satisfied. So it's not in my interests, nor is it sustainable for people to feel like they're on a budget. We just need to work out, what do you need to be happy, and to what level do you need to spend to get that happiness? Because there will be a point at which you keep spending and the happiness doesn't increase. And that's the sensitivity of your spending. So we need to understand your psychology of spending and your sensitivity, so we can start to work out the plan.
Yeah.
There's science and algorithms behind that.
No, that's awesome. I know that, you know, when I hear that now, right, because I was on almost 300,000 a year, and that was 15 years ago, right?
That's like about 4 million a year now.
Far out. Right. But now hearing that and looking at putting that plan in place, it's for me, it starts to build that emotion, right? It starts to build that emotion. And I think for a lot of athletes, that's what's missing, is getting that intrinsic motivation to see that actual, when you maximize these opportunities, this is, man, you could pay my mortgage off in 5 years.
Yeah.
Like,
and if, you know, and that's in the first year, right? So if we can have a couple of years, there's no reason we could own 10 properties if we wanted to. But I think to the reason why people don't do it is they don't realize what they're capable of doing, so they don't bother trying, or the thought of trying to do it just feels way too hard. So even if they wanted to do it, how? And so that's why we find if we can do as much of the heavy lifting for our clients as possible, it removes one of those barriers to them actually completing what they could achieve.
Yeah. Okay. I'm gonna hit you with one last big one, because this is very real for our athletes.
Yes.
Okay. Because as you know, our income is only here for a short amount of time, and then it drops. The average they say is around 75%.
Yep.
Now I've gone through in my 10 years of playing professional, I've bought a property each year for 10 years. I've been on averaging between 350 to 400,000 for those years. My final year, I'm about to finish, I won't be earning that money. What's something that they can do, or how will they be able then to service, or, you know, is that still, because that was that. Yeah, that was me. That was what I was scared about. Because, you know, I told you, I've not told you about shit in that video. I had three properties, right? And I'm like, how the hell am I going to look after this when I finish playing?
So we build that into the strategy up front.
Hmm.
So we have to recognize that the income's only there for a fixed period of time. We need to maximize progress and leverage to grow wealth. And if we're buying 10 properties, it might be that in 10 years, we sell four of them to pay off the mortgage on the others so that there's no downward pressure. But I probably would say, if we're going to try and de-risk this properly, we would look to front load the properties. So the longer that we own them, the greater chance of capital gain.
Growth, and yeah.
So if you're staggering it kind of all through your tenure at earning this money, it's not as it's not as strategic as we'd want. We prefer to go hard for 1, 2, 3 years, then de-risk it from years 3 to 6, and then ride the wave from years 6 to 10 when the capital gain comes in.
Yeah, that's so, yeah, that makes so much sense. And that's why we're talking. So, yeah, look, I guess that's for me. I'll make sure that I'll add your details and everything on the podcast. But also just wanted to say a huge thank you for taking the time out to add value and share your knowledge, but also looking forward to, attending future events as well. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Is there any sort of last words that you want, not just for athletes, but maybe anyone who's thinking about starting this journey to finally sorting out their money?
Yeah, I would say that your bank account, so your bank statements that track all your spending, that doesn't tell you what you are capable of achieving. It just tells you that if you don't have a plan, you are likely to spend everything you earn. And so I think too often people look at themselves and think, well, I've never been that successful with money and my parents aren't overly successful, therefore I don't see how I could be. Mm. And they are not connected at all. But the gap between your default and your capability comes down to mindset and behavior, some literacy and strategy, but ultimately different results.
Mm.
And if you're trying to go for big results, I mean, you can set ambitious goals, but I guess the problem with that is even the people who fail have set big goals. I don't think setting the big goals is the issue, is the thing. And that can give you some direction, yes. Mm. But it is the system and everything that ties it together. You don't rise to the level of your goals, you fall to the level of your system. So if you don't have a good system around money, and often we're our own worst enemies, identify that for what it is and let's set about changing it.
Yeah, that's such a cool message, because I know for me, right, I know that my wife and I, and moving back to New Zealand and really trying to maximize opportunities financially, we're really trying to, I don't want to say break the cycle, but at least we want to be able to be educated enough to then teach our kids. And so it carries on, because for me, it's something that I see so many athletes struggle with. But I'm really, really glad that we were able to have this chat on the podcast. And thank you again very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks for lending me your ear. If you got value out of that, please follow, subscribe, and also share this episode. And head over to athleteempire.co.nz, subscribe to our newsletter, and start to be part of this awesome community of athletes who want to be able to not only give back, but start turning their passions outside of sport into a profession and start generating a profit. Now is the time to be your athlete CEO.